If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, as a parent, you get concerned about what kind of content your kids are getting. I have a 2.5-year-old, almost 3-year-old, and you gotta sometimes give her cartoons and monitor those. And sometimes the YouTube algorithm comes up with some pretty weird stuff, actually. And it's weird how attracted she can be to that. I have to flip it off real quick. A lot of the Harry Potter stuff is based in witchcraft and black magic. And so, you got to wonder why so much child content is based that way or rooted that way. My next guest is working against that whole narrative. His name is Chad Stewart. He's author of The Britfield and the Lost Crown series. He's born in Newport Beach, California. 20 years experience in writing fiction, nonfiction, and movie screenplays. He is a prolific writer, producer, creativity specialist, international consultant, and prominent speaker. Chad Stewart, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Well, it's great to be on. Thank you. Yeah, there we go. Great to be on.
Well, and so also you're a creativity specialist. You didn't start as a creative, right? Your background was in finance. Is that right?
It was actually. I was born a creative, and we can get into that if you want. I had a really great childhood, and was involved in a lot of creative exercises, creative environments, an excellent elementary school. And again, this is going back 30, 40 years. But I originally from Newport Beach, California. I was back east, Wellesley, Massachusetts, New England, for about 16 years. Did my undergraduate in British literature, European history, which will explain, some of the books and the series and how that all came into play. Went on to grad school and then MBA, and then eventually was into investment banking and worked for Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, and Merrill Lynch. And so it was at Merrill Lynch 12 years ago when I got the idea for the Britfield series, and I was just kind of dying to do something fun, dying to do something creative. And it's when I got the idea for Britfield, and that started 12 years ago and took me 4 years, 2,500 hours just to write book one, Britfield and the Lost Crown. And then 10 years from concept to launching it officially in August, 2019. And since then, it's become one of the best-selling books within its genre and one of the most awarded books in children's fiction. And it's part of a 7-book series, 7 movies, world tours, television programs, and everything. So we can get into all of that.
So as a creative myself, I know how hard it is to stay consistent with an idea. And you're coming from a background of investment banking and stuff like that. I know that you initially thought it would be a small book, and then you allowed it to just be what it is. How did you stay focused as a writer coming from a background in finance and over the course of such a long haul? Were there creative deviations? Did you sometimes lose focus and have to start up again? And how did you battle through those things, if so?
Yeah, no, I love what you said too about, starting small and then just letting it flow. And I think that's one of the greatest things as a creative that we can do. You have a perspective or you come in with one idea, and then as you're in the creative environment, it expands into something else or bigger or different. And you have to just sort of let it flow like that. I think from the academic side and from the investment bank side, it did teach me structure, if you will, organization. And so that helped a lot with the writing process. And so it started out as really going to be like a 30-40 page children's book, with a paragraph and a picture. And then I just started writing and it was just flowing from me. And I'm like, hey, let's just see where it goes. And so, I just let it go. And then at the time I was writing too, I was only thinking one book. I was thinking something fun for children to read, an adventure takes place in present time, which I thought was very important. And then, like I said, 4 years and 2,500 hours later, we produced book one. And then at that point, I thought, gosh, we really got a series here. And book one's in England. And then I thought, I'd love to do a book two in France and then book three in Italy. And then by, where we are now is it's a 7-book series, travels the entire world. And I'm just about done with book four, Britfield and the Eastern Empire.
So I've heard you speak on Harry Potter and the sort of indoctrination of a lot of child content, the black magic aspects of it. When you had the initial idea for Britfield, did you set out to sort of fight against that stuff? I mean, was that part, was that in your mind, or did the story just naturally go someplace sort of more earthbound?
Yeah, at first, you know, at first I just wanted to write something fresh and real. I was very influenced, obviously, by Star Wars as a child, that sort of adventure. The James Bond series, I grew up on that, kind of the Roger Moore period, Spy Who Loves Me, Moonraker, so that kind of action adventure, Ian Fleming type of stuff. So I was just, I wasn't trying to hook my wagon, like I think almost most authors are today, to what's happening right now. You know, the demigods, the superheroes, the witchcraft, the vampires. And so I wanted my book just as authentic and real as possible. But I will say, you know, as I was kind of getting into it and I was starting to write book one, I had really no idea really what was on the market. I grew up with the Hardy Boys, of course, C.S. Lewis, The Witch and the Lion, The Witch in the Wardrobe. I loved Runaway Ralph, The Mouse and the Motorcycle. And then some, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach. Those are some of my favorite books. And so I went to the bookstore. I'll never forget going to a Barnes & Noble, just going over to like the sort of middle school young adult section. And it was at that point, I was really, frankly, I was horrified to see what was out there. I mean, it's just saturated with this real dark stuff. You know what I mean? Again, you know, the witchcraft and the vampires and the occultism and anything except what's real and natural and here. And so I think at that point, it really became much more of a mission of countering the narrative that's out there and delivering to kids really what they want, what they need, an edifying book to lift their spirits to, you know, as kids are reading Britain Lost Crown, as adults are reading Britain Lost Crown, they're learning about architecture, geography, history, culture. Our main themes are family, friendship, loyalty, courage, hope, and faith. And we're tying in creativity, critical thinking, communication, and collaboration into every single book. And so it's kind of like a stealth education process as kids are reading it. You know, number one, they're grounded, current times, real places, real maps, real locations, all these different things that are happening. So it's connecting to them. They're connecting to real characters, because it's like when Tom and Sarah, the main characters, have to solve a problem, they're not waving a wand, they're not saying a spell, they're not putting on a cloak, they're not, you know, clicking their heels with some kind of magical power. I mean, they really have to deal with the situations and the problems that they're faced with, simple and sometimes complex. And so what we're doing is we're really teaching children, again, or reteaching them, how to think for themselves and how to collaborate and how to communicate and how to look at things from a critical standpoint. And sometimes Tom and Sarah, my characters, they talk and they have the right answer and they succeed. Sometimes they have the wrong answer and they learn quickly. And this type of, again, stealth education is really impacting the hearts and minds of today's generations. And we believe that Britfield will not only outsell the Harry Potter series in the next 10 years, but it is this generation's book series. And what we're doing with it is we're literally raising the bar in literature. And so all those that don't want to sort of follow suit and write good content, fine. You'll be falling along the waistline there. So that's our objective. That's what it's become. It's become much more of a mission. We've always said it's more than a book. It's a mission. More than a book, it's a movement in literature, literacy, family values.
Are you a parent? Is that why you wanted to go into child's content? I mean, how, when you're writing for children, do you sometimes edit yourself out of more adult themes or language? I mean, how do you sort of galvanize your writing towards children? And what initially motivated you to write for children?
Perfect questions. And book one, you know, takes place in present time, starts up in Yorkshire, Northern England. Tom and Sarah are 12 years old. And so I'm very aware of that age group. We can all kind of go back to 12. And it was such a very, very cool age. And then in book two, Tom and Sarah are 13 years old. Book three, they're 14 years old. And you know, as we well know, a child from 12 to 13 is like a decade, right? And from 13 to 14, they grow very quick. They mature very quickly. So I'm very aware of that particular time frame, if you will. And so I am very careful in writing it. But with that said too, I feel much like C.S. Lewis, because C.S. Lewis started the entire Narnia series for adults. He wanted to bring this sort of fantasy, exciting fiction to adults within a child setting. And I feel like I'm doing so much of that. Half of our readers are adults, and we have feedback worldwide. Our youngest reader is 7, our oldest reader is 93 years old. And we're receiving feedback all the time from mothers and from fathers and from teachers that have read the series and just love it. And so I think it really is designed to sort of be that type of book, but it is geared towards really middle school and young adult. So. But I don't actually, to answer your question, I don't, I'm not married. I don't have kids. And so it's interesting.
That's interesting.
How I got involved in all this, right? I mean, you'd think I'd had sort of like Winnie the Pooh, you know what I mean? I have this little child and I'm reading him stories and I think, gosh, this would be really good. And I didn't. I think I've just always been, I've been a creative at heart, like we said at the very beginning. And, and you get kind of stuck into the system, don't you? It's like, you got to get a job and you got to earn money. And then in the current climate, it's just like, it's really hard. And it's like, you can't really do what you want to do. You do what you have to do. And we get pulled away from, really, so many of us get pulled away from who we are and what we should be doing, what we've been called to do. Cause we're all creatives. We're all born with creativity. And so you might not feel it, you know, you might feel that you're very analytical and you're not creative. You are creative. That creativity is inside you. We all have that gift. You just have to be in the right environment to have it, you know, to be exposed to it. And I was lucky, you know, I had a great elementary school, had a great sixth grade class, and she brought in a lot of creative exercises that were fun to do, and that got me thinking. See, kids don't know what they're capable of doing until you give them an opportunity to do it. Kids can never know, you know, what they can build unless you give them building blocks, or what they could color unless you give them crowns and paper. And it's not to say that everyone's going to be an architect or an artist, but it's giving that environment, you know, to create and to think and to see what hits, what sticks. And so I was fortunate at a young age, and our first assignment in sixth grade was to write a book. And I think it was like, had to be 25 pages, and it could be a paragraph and then like a picture. But, you know, and it's like at 12 years old, you're like, oh my gosh, it's like, you know, it was like a third of our grade. And so you're a bit overwhelmed, but you're put in a situation where you have to do something, you have to produce, and you have to tap inside yourself. And I learned very young that you write about what you know and you write about what you love. And my first official book was called James Bond, Eat Your Heart Out. And I was a 12-year-old secret agent working for the British government in England, living down in Hampshire in a beautiful Tudor-style home, had a Ferrari and a butler. You know, this is great. This is the creative mind as a kid, right? I mean, there's no boundaries to it. And then, you know, I ended up chasing this villain all through Europe. And fast forward 40 years later, Britfield and the Lost Crown. And because of those seeds being planted, because of having an opportunity to tap something that I did not know was inside me, really set that pace. And it wasn't to say that when after I wrote that book or at 12 years old, I wanted to be an author. That wasn't my focus or goal. But I did enjoy storytelling. And by the time I was 18, I started writing movie scripts and was taking classes and working with professionals. And so I really learned the craft of writing a great story, which I think is missing in most of the literature. And definitely most of the movies today and even television programs.
Have you found any resistance in, you know, bucking the system, so to speak, of going against the black magic, the witchcraft, and all that kind of stuff? Is there an inside scoop you can give us on some of the dealings you've had with people who said, hey, maybe throw a witch in this or something like that?
Yeah, I knew at an early stage that we would have to have complete creative control. And so, you know, starting 12 years ago, we put together an extremely in-depth business plan, marketing plan, built a incredible team of, you know, national, worldwide experts, whether just advisory or consultants or whatever, and really built our own infrastructure. We really built a media empire around Britfield. And I say that not to dissuade people that want to do something, but I knew that was needed. I didn't have to sit there and be dictated by a publisher to say, you know, you need to remove this or put that in there. And it's like, screw you, pound salt. You know what I mean? You're not touching my work. And so it is, it's a huge, massive undertaking. And it's exciting right now for us because we are in May next month. Couple weeks from now, we're shifting into our global launch. So everything we've done for Britfield, everything that you've seen and we've talked about, all the interviews we've done, has been a soft launch. We've spent 5 years just on a soft launch throughout the United States, testing it, piloting it, building the brand, launching book one, and then we had to launch book two, and then we had to launch book three. And so it's been a heck of a process. Yeah.
Why do you think there's not more stories like Britfield? Why do you think the child content usually goes towards Harry Potter or magical thinking or the black magic stuff? What do you have any sort of conspiratorial angles on that?
Sure. Well, number one, you have 96% of the entire media owned by six corporations, all interlocking corporations, all the same sort of suspects people to push an agenda, you know, and that's everything from your publishing houses to your magazines, to your online resources, to television, to mainstream media, to films. It's all owned and controlled by this group. That's a fact. And so they're pushing the agenda. And I think, and again, too, it's like, and then yet there's all these other authors, even sort of conservatives. And so what do? Instead of writing something really great, they hook their wagon to this sort of witchcraft stuff. And, you know, it's my sister's brother's witch, you know what I mean? Or they try to come up with this fantasy stuff to hook their wagon to this sort of quote unquote popular genre. And it's not popular, really. I mean, Harry Potter, and that's a whole nother story. Had a lot of writers, if you will, involved in that. That's a multi-billion dollar marketing campaign to bring witchcraft and black magic into the hearts and minds of children. So that wasn't just some old, you know, woman scribbling together some ideas, and lo and behold, oh my gosh, this thing blossomed into, as of today, it's a $34 billion franchise. Mm-hmm. You know, that just happened, happenstance. There is no happenstance. All by design, all orchestrated. So,
why do you think that there is this agenda for black magic? What do you think is at the root of it? Is this the heart of evil operating through children? Sure. Or do you just think it's because it's popular? Or do you think it's an anti-Christian agenda? I mean, why?
Yeah, I mean, there's the thing is what they set up as the model is good witches versus bad witches. Right. And there's no such thing as a good witch. You know, witchcraft in and of itself is horrific. You know, it's demonic, whether you believe in it or not. People that practice it do. Good vampires versus bad vampires. No, there aren't any good vampires. And so that's the kind of narrative they're sort of creating. And so you suddenly have kids literally saying occult like spells. I mean, a lot of the stuff in the books are real occult spells, real witchcraft spells. There's a lot of conservatives and Christian families that still have these books on their shelves. I mean, like, are you crazy? Kind of caught up in the whole whirlwind of it, but there's nothing good about it. It's a very demonic, anti-family, anti-Christian focus. I mean, that's kind of matter of fact. It's not open for debate. So.
Interesting. All right, let me take a quick break. We'll be right back with Chad Stewart right after these words on TNT.
TNT's Dirk Pohlman.
There was a plan on the British side to immediately after the victory over Germany to continue the war, to push the weakened Soviet Union back over over backwards. Yeah, so that is something that is not well known. That plan has been, you could find it on the internet and then it's off and on sometimes again. It's very difficult. It's not long. It's something like, if I recall correctly, something of 30 pages, I would say. I read it.
The Soviets had this coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948. And that appeared as the Soviets really was pushing forward, and they would, they thought that this means that we have to start an alliance against the Soviets. And that was NATO became.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And we're back with Chad Stewart, author of the Britfield and Lost Crown series. So, Chad, you were talking about putting together a massive team for marketing. I'm a creative, too. I make records. I make paintings and stuff like that. Marketing is something I was always, like, I come from sort of the 90s, you know, when Nirvana and all that stuff, even though those guys were expertly marketed, the whole narrative was, you can't even try to make money. If you do, you're a sellout. So a lot of that stuff has neutered my artistry, I think, in some ways. And marketing is something I'm thinking of a lot more these days. And you read things like, you know, you present a problem, you exaggerate the problem, and then you come up with a solution and sort of, I forget what that's called, but it's some sort of manipulative tactic that ropes.
Oh, no, it's a problem, reaction, solution.
Right. Problem, reaction, solution. So in terms of Britfield and what you're doing now, how do you go about marketing something like that? Do you utilize problem, reaction, solution and all that kind of stuff, or what? What do you do?
No, and those are great questions and stuff. And no, it's a big question, because it's a massive undertaking as far as marketing. It's not sort of one vehicle or one medium, if you will. Is it social media, or is it emails, or is it, you know, book signings or school tours? It's a combination of all of it. And it's been 5 years of hard work. And it's interesting too. It's a couple things about marketing. Number one, if you fail fast. I just always love that. It's like, I don't need a month to realize that a campaign isn't rolling out. I know really honestly within a couple of hours if it's hitting or not hitting its mark. You have to be agile and flexible. You know what I mean? You might sit there and say, this is the way we're going to do it, and it's just not hooking or working. And so you adapt and build on it. I think marketing is storytelling. And the better storyteller you are, the better you can be at marketing. I just had this discussion with a couple investment bankers 2 days ago. In fact, his background, one of these investment bankers, he was hired on because he's a storyteller. And as they're trying to expand their company, it's the story that you tell. And so what's the story that we're telling, you know, about Britfield? How are we articulating that? What's the hook? Why are, you know, out of millions of books that are available out there, how do we get our message across? And so that has been sort of the art of the message, art of the story. And the difference with the story too is it's never over, right? It's not like you roll out your marketing campaign over 3 months and then it's like you sit back and wait for everybody to come. It doesn't happen that way. Marketing never ends. Once you're in for good. Meaning, like, if you have a company, you're going to be marketing your company for the rest of the existence of that company. Unless you, for some reason, get to a certain place where, you know, I can't imagine, but you know what I mean? Like, you're making so much money, you're like, no more marketing. Cause it's hard. It's just, I mean, the competition's out, everything's changed. The landscapes have changed. The competition's out there. It's not just national, it's global. You know, something that's new today in California has already been, you know, is already old, you know, 2 weeks old in Japan. You know what I mean? I mean, things are shifting and moving. This is not only in technology, but in everything else. And so it's hard. You got to sort of maintain on that. But for us, it's never compromising our integrity. It's never trying to create something that's false. It's really, in fact, the exciting part about it, you could almost say the sexy part of it in today's society is just being honest and real. And we know we have a great product. In many ways, we've reinvented the mousetrap. And kids love it. You know what I mean? We know that. You know, the children that read it love it. We have, you know, 12-year-olds devouring Britfield Lost Crown in 5 hours. I've got, you know, letters coming in all the time to us, you know, from schools and from kids that have read the books and stuff and love it. And they're asking me, when's book four coming? When's the movie coming? So we know we're hitting our target. We know we're hitting our market. And we did that just because we wrote the best possible book we could. We compromised nothing. And we delivered what was needed. There's a 90% worldwide gap for good, wholesome content. Don't let any of the statistics or any of the mainstream nonsense fool you. That's why, coming back to your previous question, you know, about, you know, why is it such a saturated market? Well, number one, it's saturated by those that are trying to saturate it and create a false narrative, if you will, that this sells, witchcraft sells. And there's always going to be something attractive to it. But I'll be honest, if you gave me $1 billion, I could market anything and have you speaking pig Latin and walking backwards in 6 months. It's not that difficult. You know what I mean?
Really?
But it doesn't
teach
stick.
Me. Well, so right? You're saying good marketing is telling a story. So in this case, you know, what I glommed onto right away was, this is sort of the anti Harry Potter. You know, is that the story that you're putting out there, that you guys
it's
are
not,
sort of the resistance?
You don't really Yeah, and it's not kind of what we're trying to do. We don't try to attack what's out there, really. You know, we're doing an interview, so we're talking, if you will, and I'm telling you a little bit about behind the scenes and what's out there. But for our marketing and in general, you know, we don't attack what other people might enjoy or like. We just offer a better product, and whether you like it or you don't, you know what I mean. It's just like it's just providing, you know, a better story, and it's a story. It's like a not, yeah, it's an ongoing story too. It's like week by week, month by month. It's like, just this morning, we're getting ready to roll out our promotions for book four. You know what I mean? So that's the next story. Right. Soon, in 6 weeks, we'll be talking about the movie, and trailers for the movie will start coming out in 3 months. So it's that kind of, like, you know, multi-level strategy, 3 to 5 years, every week coming up with something, if you will. It's hard. I'm not saying it's easy.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, how are you differentiating yourself from the other content out there? I mean, when you market it, and we'll get off marketing, but I'm just really curious.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
You're telling the story about the story to provoke people to glom onto it, right? I mean, sure. how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, I think some of the lines that we've used is one of the most awarded books in children's fiction. So that's exciting, and that's
an. But how do you do it before it's awarded? Like early marketing. Like, how do you do it before it's awarded, when you have nothing?
I think it's if you can always capture it, they call it taglines, and if you can capture everything in one sentence, you know, one line that just intrigues you. And I'll give you an example. One of my favorite movies, obviously, Die Hard. And it's like the tagline was
obviously
a New York.
It's all of our favorite movie,
right? Here's the tagline: a New York cop visits his estranged wife in L.A. when her building is overtaken by terrorists. You know, mm-hmm. So you have a New York cop visiting his estranged wife in L.A. New York, L.A. worlds of difference. Estranged wife, so his tail's between his leg. When her building is taken over by terrorists, it's like, gee, I wonder what's going to happen. I mean, it's just such a great tagline that tells you a lot. You know, like a New York cop, you think he's going to put up with it? You know, so I'm giving that as like a great tagline. So if you can kind of come up with that tagline, that's a hook. I mean, think about yourself if you were a soda or a cola beverage coming in and trying to compete against Pepsi or Coca-Cola. I mean, what's your why? Why do I want to drink you? It's like, you know, what's the hook? You know, it tastes better than Pepsi, or it tastes better than Coke, or, you know, the real cola, all natural ingredients. Or, I mean, you know, something. You know, like you got to come up with something. So with us, it's
why,
like,
do I want to drink out. You? Yeah, why do I want to drink you? Is a good tagline, actually. You know, yeah. For a new cola. Now, talk about the actual writing of stuff. I asked you a little bit earlier, but. I know how difficult it is to stay consistent. You said your previous career made you more organized. But how did you stay true to the vision, and talk about overcoming difficulties in writing, and also turn down your radio, I think, because I hear my voice coming back at me.
Oh, okay. I don't have my headphones in, but
gotta get those headphones. Come on, Chad.
Yeah, I can plug those in a second. Yeah, let me answer your question. Yeah, so it's a big undertaking for me to write a story. What's interesting is like with book one, Riffian Lost Crown, I put everything I had as a writer into it. If that makes sense, it's like we all have these sort of ideas or tricks or twists and things like that. And I was almost like emptied out on book one. And it's like, now what are you gonna do with book two? So I do like that challenge, that I don't hold anything back, but I have to sort of raise the bar. In the story and the stakes in everything. So that's an ongoing challenge that I need to overcome, and it's not always easy. Number two, especially after book two, I spend about 3 to 4 months just outlining my book. So let's just take book four right now. I don't have it with me. I spent 4 weeks last year, starting in January, I spent 4 months, I'm sorry, 4 months outlining the entire story. And really it's just bullet points. It's like 1 to 2 lines. That's going to be a scene, a major scene. And so I put everything together first. I figured out my entire story, the character arcs, plot point one, plot point two, midpoint. I laid it all out. The best way I could say it is it's like literary architecture. You know, if you're going to go out and build a home, and you're like, hey, I got this picture of this really cool modern building, let's order up the material. It's like, are you kidding me? It's like disaster. But you sit down with an architect. You know what I mean? And you work on it, and you figure out how big it's going to be. And the structural walls, the second story, you get like 90% of the details into the architectural plans. And now you know exactly what you want to build. And then along the way, you might say, hey, I want to add a window here, or let's expand this, or let's use a different color. And that's the way it is with me for writing. It's hard. It's like, I call it front loaded, because it's like, it's easy to sort of sit down and start writing, but you don't really know where you're going to go. And then all of a sudden you might write into it yourself into what we call a roadblock. And you're like, oh my gosh, what do I do in this scene? But I've already figured it all out. And so it's a very engrossed process. And I'm excited right now because I'm like 4%. I'm 10 days away from finishing book four.
Yeah.
It's just like on and on.
Well,
and
we
on.
Know you're going to get book four done. That's not really the challenge. Yeah. The challenge was when you went from being an investment banker into being a writer and you're in like, you know, what's your process? You're waking up every morning and at this point, you don't have any success at all. You might be deluding yourself. I'm sure there's demons in your mind trying to talk you out of it. I mean, famously in that book, The War of Art, Stephen Pressfield, I think is his name, talks about resistance and stuff like that. How did you overcome the early struggles? Okay, let's go to a quick break. We got some technical difficulties. We'll be right back after these words on TNT.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses. But there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision that this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
The mornings, that's my time. Watching the sun come up, I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
The next time you think you can illegally handle your mobile phone while driving and get away with it, think again. Phone detection cameras are in operation on New South Wales roads.
Hello.
So if you're driving and illegally handle your mobile phone, you can stop it or cop it.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
With Chad Stewart. So Chad, one of my favorite subjects is overcoming resistance in the creative act. Now you're talking about some of your later, you know, working on book four. It's like, it's a wrap. You know, you're going to do it. You're already successful. Yeah. You know, you got success. You're proven. But I'm interested in early Chad going like, I'm just a guy with a dream coming from investment banking, a straight life. All of a sudden you're a creative. It takes enormous will. Writing a huge book, you have to sort of come up with a schedule. I mean, people do it all different ways. A lot of writers talk about waking up early with the coffee, and you know, Stephen Pressfield, The War of Art, talks about, you know, you just got to kind of be consistent and overcome what's known as resistance. I want to know how you overcame the early demons, the ones that said, you're nuts, man, what are you doing? No one's going to want to read this. Why are you spending all this time? How'd you overcome that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you something real quick too, especially as you're a young author. One of the worst things that can happen is like, you know, you might be writing your book and then you walk into Barnes & Noble and it's just like, it's so overwhelming because there's like thousands of books and you feel so small. So I don't spend a lot of time at bookstores anymore. But anyway, it is. It's discipline, like anything else. I was kind of talking about, you know, anything that you're going to get into. It's not just writing, it's any sport, you know what I mean? Basketball. How good are you going to get at basketball if you're just, you know, going out once a week to practice? Or if you're going to run a marathon, are you running twice a week? No, you're probably training, you know, 5 to 6 days a week. It's the same thing with writing, and it is a discipline. We're all different. So meaning like I'm a morning person. And so I like to start exactly at 7 o'clock. I don't want to start at 7:30. I don't want to start at 8. Sometimes, of course, you know, you have a phone call or this or that, but I just like to start boom right at 7 o'clock. And then I'll try to write, you know, for about 2 to 3 hours and take a break. And then come back and then write more. My best time really is at 7 to 9. That's the most creative time. And with that said, it's just like even today, Saturday, quite frankly, I'm just really tired. It's been a long week and I was writing this morning and I did not feel like writing, but it's the discipline. I sat down, and sometimes it's not about writing something new. And if you're stuck, you know what I mean? Then just jump back 3 or 4 pages and start editing what you've already written. And that's a great way to not only make your story better, but to warm up, And so I often will do that. Sometimes I'll sit down and I'll just start on the new scene because I'm like, I got it in my mind. I got all this creative juice. Let's produce it. And it's like, it's great. You're in a flow. You know, there's a great book out there called Flow. You're in your flow, you know, 2 hours. I'm just like, oh my gosh. It's like, and then sometimes you're like, I don't know what I'm going to write, or I don't have anything. So I'll jump back. I'll jump back 3 or 4 pages. Now, keep in mind, as a writer, it's only 20% writing and 80% rewriting and editing. So, you know, while the 20% is the hardest, that's creating your whole first draft story, you're going to spend 80% of your time coming over that over and over and over again, refining it, expanding, tightening, making it better. So you know, every morning, it's just like, if you're already just jumping into some editing, it's okay, because you're going to be editing a lot anyway. And so these are some of the things that I do. What does help me now as a writer is outlining it. So I don't kind of come up and I finish the scene and I'm like, okay, now what? You know what I mean? I've already figured it out. Right. I just jump into my next scene and stuff. So another thing you can do too, let's just say you're starting out, this is your first book, spend some time just outlining it. You know, like I said, you always have to have your beginning and your end, because if you don't have an ending for your story, it's like taking a road trip for 3 weeks and you don't know where you're going, right? You're like, all right, everybody in the car, let's start driving. It's just like, we've got no destination. Now your ending could change as your story develops, but you need to sort of know where you're going, what you're aiming for. So to have a beginning and an ending, figuring out at least some of your critical scenes, you know, again, too, like for me, it's very easy, because if it's like book two is going to take place in France, it's going to begin on this little island outcrop. And then where do I want to go? Well, I definitely want to go to Paris. You know what I mean? And then where do I want to go in Paris? Well, we got to go to Notre Dame, and we'll go to the museum. And, you know what I mean? I have Eiffel Tower. And so these are all scenes, right? And so these are kind of, I can start to kind of outline that and get a general sense of it. You can
just avoid Pigalle, because it's a kid's book. That's the red light district.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah. Noted. And then like, so who are your characters? And so sometimes if you're stuck or you don't know what your story, your next part of your story is, just dive deep into your characters. And do little character biographies. What's their strengths? What's their weaknesses? I always loved this. I heard this from an author. She said, what's a secret that they're keeping? And I thought, oh, isn't that cool? Like each one of your characters, is there some secret that they're keeping and suddenly gets exposed? Or, you know, having, if one of their weaknesses is that they're afraid of the dark, or they're claustrophobic, what if they get locked in the closet? Wow. They got to overcome that and stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of different things that you can do. But this is the thing, to answer your question, is just always be writing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Whether you're editing, writing, thinking, researching. Sometimes, even now, I'm just like, man, I'm in a funk. I don't feel like writing. But I know that the next scene's going to be in this, you know, place or city. I start doing some research. And I know it's like going to be at this particular building or park. And I can start pulling up some research and grabbing some of the descriptions and stuff. So there's just always something that you could be doing, you know, and it's just like that. You know, it's like, do you think everyone that plays a professional sport feels like getting up every morning at 5 a.m. and running 6 miles? You know what I mean? Or going to another practice or whatever it is, you know, you just do it. And that's the discipline.
Do you take any days off? Cause this is Saturday. You said you wrote today. Do you take a Sunday off, or do you write 7 days a week?
I do take Mondays off from writing, which is interesting. Writing is, Mondays are my administrative day, right? It's Monday. And so there's just a ton of stuff that I have to do, follow up, phone calls, interviews, and meetings, all kinds of stuff. So Mondays is my one day that I take off, and it's nice. It feels good, because it's like, you know, but you do build a very nice momentum. And so sometimes Tuesday morning, it's like, I got to kind of get back into the groove of it and stuff. But
Yeah, momentum is huge with creativity. I mean, and you spoke of the technical aspects of it. You know, you write every day at 7, and that's great. But what about the internal demons? How much do you deal with those? The internal landscape, the stuff that, like, the voices in your head. I mean, did you ever go through depression where you got off your grind and you lost momentum for weeks on end and got it back? Talk about that, if that ever happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember even in book one, we can go all the way to the beginning, and it was mid-section in book one, Britfield Lost Crown, and it was at Windsor Castle. And it's probably my favorite scene in the entire book. And I suddenly, as I was writing it, and this is the excitement about writing, is I had a sort of preconceived idea of how the scene would be. And all of a sudden, someone that was helping Tom and Sarah in this situation ended up being a villain. And I didn't plan that. It came out you know, in it. And I thought, oh my gosh, that changes everything. You know what I mean? Like, so all this idea for the scene and the momentum. And so really, once I had that idea, I had to sort of stop because it changed everything. And I didn't know what to do next, if you will. I didn't know how to write the next scene. And so that at that point, I stopped. I jumped back all the way to the beginning and just started editing all the way up until that scene again. And it gave me time to sort of think and process what was going to happen. So that was kind of one thing. There's you know, it's funny too, because it's Emerson has a great quote, and he says, critics are failed artists and writers, right? And I say that because, you know, you'll get attacked by a lot of people that don't know the first thing of what they're doing, you know, like book reviewers or something. It's just like, well, that's, you know, I don't mind being reviewed by a best-selling author. You know what I mean? It's just like, cause you know, the realm, you know, the work, you know, what you've done has been successful. None of these people are best-selling authors. Most of them haven't even sold 500 books, you know? So you're dealing with that kind of market. Things that you'll realize is that people in publishing don't know the first thing about publishing. 97 out of all 100 books that are published traditionally fail to make a profit. Most books don't sell more than 200 to 300 to 500 books in their entire lifetime. And if your book sells more than 2,000 books in its lifetime, it's done well. A bestseller is anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 books. So you're dealing with an industry that just throws everything at the wall. They don't know anything. You know, like the famous story of Chicken Soup for the Soul. He was rejected by over 130 publishers, and now it's a $1 billion corporation. Pippi Longstocking was rejected by every single publisher. Now it's a beloved children's special. Pretty much that's the norm in the industry behind all these great successes. The Help, if you're familiar with the book, The Help, and then the movie, the successful movie. Nah, that was turned.
That I'm
was
not
turned
sure down about by, that.
That was turned down by 60 literary agents.
In the music business, there's all these stories too. Well, I mean, like, yeah. Led Zeppelin famously got like 2-star reviews in Rolling Stone. Led Zeppelin. I'm trying to go for here with you is the dark night of the soul. And if you've ever experienced it, well, you're describing the Windsor Palace thing, and it's like, well, you didn't really stop. You just started editing more. I'm talking about, did you ever have full scale breakdowns where you had to like start a month later after sort of really dropping the ball? Did the dark night of the soul ever loom over you?
I think I've hit walls, and we all do. You know, excellence has a great cost, and it's what we strive for. You know, anything of value takes a lot of time, effort, and defeat. You talked about, I think you asked earlier, you know, have you had any rejection or defeats? And it's just like, yeah, absolutely. Who hasn't? And so what doesn't, you know, break you will make you. And there's great truth to that. If you let it sink in and destroy you, then you never succeed and move on. I mean, it's just, I've done so much research. I'm big into biographies, and I'm coming full circle to answer your question. But it's just like, behind all these stories is massive failure. And so at least I think I was well informed in that. So I wasn't kind of a novice. I knew a lot of stories of authors that reject. I mean, the funny thing is like Roald Dahl, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach. He had a very good literary agent in New York. He got those books published in New York and America and was rejected in Britain. He couldn't get his books published in Britain. They didn't want them. You know, I mean, now they're bestsellers. And it's just like, what? So I knew a lot of these stories kind of coming in. But yeah, I did. I hit my walls. And sometimes you would take a month off. You know, you're like, I need a break, or I'm done. I don't think I ever hit a point where I said, I'm not going to complete this.
Right.
Although I might have wrestled with some of those, if you will, demons and stuff that were breaking you down. That's kind of what I was talking about, the critics. And it's not like we've had a lot of critic stuff, but it doesn't take a lot. You know, one person says, oh, I didn't like it, or this is terrible. Or, you know, I remember we were sending out the manuscript for book one, and I was getting, you know, from top literary agents, and they were like, oh, it's too long. And I'm like, excuse me, have you been to the bookstore and seen Harry Potter? It's just like, I mean, like, again, it's that disconnect from reality. It's like, it's not too long. I mean, any kid that loves a good book will love a good book. And so they don't know what they're talking about. You know what I mean? It's just like, you're dealing with a lot of idiots and novice, let's be honest. And you have to push through that. And it's tough. You know, it's tough. So.
Well, I mean, a lot, the greatest stories are the hero's journey. And to write a story about the hero's journey, you also have to go through the hero's journey. I mean, what was it like when you got accepted by a publishing house? How did that go?
I have a great literary agent out of New York, and it was really cool. And I did my research coming in, if you will. So There might be, I don't know, thousands of literary agents out there. There's probably only 50 to 100 that are worth their salt that have any kind of value to them. And you have to be very smart in picking them. You know, you're not going to be, if you're writing a children's book, you're not picking an agent that deals with adult fiction or romance. You know what I mean? And so it was interesting with her. Her 15-year-old daughter got the manuscript, and her 15-year-old daughter grabbed the Britfield Lost Crown manuscript, sat down and read it in one reading, which is incredible. So she didn't get up until she finished it. And so I was fortunate that I found a great literary agent, and she's smart and savvy. The difference with her is she's been in the industry for 30 years. She worked at Little Brown. She worked at Random House, worked with Malcolm Gladwell. Tom Clancy. I mean, all the biggies. And so I was very fortunate in that sense, but it was a journey, and it took a lot of time to find the right one. And we're still on that journey. We're still, you know, struggling. We're just about to sell the international rights to South Korea and Japan, which is exciting for the Britfield series. Those two beachheads will really dominate the entire Asian market. And that's part of our strategy, which is exciting. Our first international rights sale was a couple of years ago to Poland, which is, so all three books are now published in Polish. But that was exciting for us because Poland is our beachhead for Eastern Europe. And we've got a 2-month tour of 10 countries planned coming up in the fall. So we've got a lot into this thing and a lot of different things planned.
And now it's going to be a film series as well. Did Correct. You write the scripts? Did a script writer come in and base it off your story? I mean, how did that work? And what's the steps towards making this, a big film industry?
Yeah, it's always been about the movie, which is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is I've always loved film and been fascinated with it. I was involved in the industry when I was younger. Had been writing scripts for years, and really just kind of the same script. I have different scripts, but it's like you don't write a script a year. It's like, you know, you might write the first draft in a year, you know what I mean? And then the second draft, the third draft. But what all of that did is taught me, as I said, to be very refined. What's interesting about a movie script is if you're doing a 90-minute movie, you usually will produce about a 90 to 100 page script because every page is a minute, and there's a pretty concise accuracy to that. And so that's why when someone brings, hey, I got this 300 page movie script, I'm like, what are you doing, a miniseries? You know, go ahead and cut it down to at least half and then get back to me. But all of that taught me refinement. It taught me the three act structure, taught me to enter late and leave early on every single scene and not waste time, if you will. 2 to 3 sentence descriptions, not long paragraphs. Tight dialogue, not rambling, because again, a minute of film time and stuff. So that's all the stuff I sort of learned going into it. With that said, I'm not a professional script writer. And so we did hire someone, what are we in now? April, January of 2000, last year, January of last year. And so that was a very long process. I had been developing the relationship with him for over a year to see if he was the right one. And he'd been in the industry for about 30 years. He's produced about 30 to 40 major motion picture movie scripts. He's worked with a lot of the huge studios. And so he started it. He did the first draft. I gave him the producer because we already have I've had the producer team in place for over 2.5 years. It's been in that development that long. And we're now moving into pre-production. So we went through it, 37 pages of notes. It's a lot for the first draft. Got the second draft back. And then at that point, after giving feedback, I took over to the third draft. And I got it from 168 pages to 148 pages. This is the final third draft movie script, about $250,000, just to give you kind of a mindset of the cost involved. And wow. You were talking about sort of like your ruts in writing. I dove into that in November, and it took me 5 weeks. And so that's a November I'll never get back to, because I had to come in and just sort of really get it back on track and refine it and do everything. And then January this year, I thought I was going to come back just for a quick, you know, read through on the script, and scripts can kind of read pretty quick. I thought it was, you know, where it was, and I thought I'd spend 4 days. I spent 10 days. And so again, that's 10 days I'll never get back, but to refine it. And then we actually did our first read through with professional actors, 6 children actors and 6 adult actors with the producer about a month ago at a beautiful location, big boardroom. We kind of sat in the back, and then they were just reading through all the different characters and stuff. And we take breaks every 30 pages, 30 minutes or something like that. So it's great. So it's really, it's done. It's refined. I'm the script is exhilarating. The script is amazing. We honestly do predict that the first Britfield movie will be one of the highest grossing films in cinematic history. We believe that we will break box office records, and we believe that we'll be delivering to the worldwide audience something that they haven't seen before. I mean, it's they have and they haven't, if that makes sense. It's just so, it's so packed. It's so fast paced. It's so exciting. It's so heartfelt. It's got everything in it. So.
Now, how important is manifestation to you? I mean, when you talk like that, I've heard you say that too in other interviews, that it's going to be the biggest thing ever and all that kind of stuff. Is this is like, you know, like somebody might be like, who does this guy think he is? Or is that important to put that sort of vision out into the world and sort of reinstate it or state it and make it a reality? Do you practice manifestation?
Yeah, and I understand that. And I think, you know, as a man speaks, so is he. And you stand far better chance of hitting your target if you aim for it. There's all those aspects to it. I wouldn't say it if I didn't believe it wholeheartedly. And I have to say it because it's the truth, or it's within inside me, if that makes sense. You know, I'm not trying to be arrogant in any sense of the word. But I also say it too, to, if you will, provoke a reaction and say, well, how do you think that, or why do you think that? And then I could tell you. And I mean, look at what Hollywood's been putting out right now. It is filth. It's garbage. 98% of everything that's coming out of Hollywood right now is absolute crap. The last four Disney movies have been complete disasters. Disney's down by 40 to 50%, hanging on by a thread to complete bankruptcy. Now they'll rally on, you know. I mean, just everything that's coming out of Hollywood, it's all by design. It's not by mistake, but it's just garbage and filth. You know what I mean? It's just terrible. And that's not what the people want, you know. And it's like, well, they're producing what people want. So, and yeah, every now and then you'll get a zinger like Barbie. It's like, where that came from. But again, too, I think it's just the hunger and starvation for parents just to have something to go see, you know. And plus, it's based on,
trust me, bro. I have a almost 3-year-old. So like, when a good movie comes into the theater down the street, you know, I take her. You know, yeah, it's like, yeah. I've seen you know, Paw Patrol twice in the theater, dude. Like, you know, yeah. Like, so yeah, I get it. But do you guys have a movie studio behind this yet, or are you still looking for that?
No, we have some things we can talk about, some things we cannot. We already have our distributor locked in, a major distributor. It's the right fit for the film. We're putting together our team now. We've got our dream directors, if you will, and probably within 6 to 8, maybe 10 weeks, we'll be reaching out to them. For us, everything will start to happen very quickly, if that makes sense, because again, just like the book series, we have complete creative control. It'll be done independently outside the studios, but we will use the studios for the distribution and marketing of it. So the best of both worlds. We'll be funding it ourselves. It'll be a $50 million movie, which by Hollywood standards would be about $125 million. So you take this movie script, the exact same movie, you go to Hollywood and it now is $150 million because everybody there lines their pockets and just bureaucracy and fraud. So, yeah, so it's just like, it's a lot of planning. Can you imagine 2.5 years of planning a film and going through all the details? So when the trigger is ready to be pulled, I mean, we're going to start looking at site locations in England and elsewhere within probably 6 to 8 weeks. That's exciting. We'll start making offers to actors. We've already picked everybody that we want, if you will. Now it's just kind of bringing it all together. And the script is beautiful. Now, with that said, I know some scripts are like 8 drafts, but a lot of times, because you got a lot of writers that don't know what they're doing. It's really hard too to find a successful movie in a single writer. You know what I mean? And it's like, I think even with Gladiator, you know, had 8 or 10 drafts and gosh, I don't know, 10 different writers involved in it. But with that said,
I got to catch off, Chad. Thank you very much for coming on. Tell everyone where to find you and where to find the book.
Oh yeah, check out Britfield.com. It's BRITFIELD, Britfield.com. It's our award-winning website. You can, if you purchase books through that, you can get signed copies. I'm still doing that while I have time. Or Amazon.
Hurry up. All right, okay. Cool. Thanks, Chad Stewart. Thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks. A lot of fun. Good questions.
Thanks, bro. Have a good day. Keep listening to TNT, everybody. We'll be right back.